if you're constantly just on the kind of like surviving level, it just, you know, we call it Brotlose of Kunst, and yes, that does exist, but you at some point will face the junction where you actually start to compromise yourself. And I actually, you know, when I was younger, I, you know, collected young artists. And what I noticed is the ones that have something that can keep them, you know, above the waterline financially, they're almost in a paradoxically way, not the ones that go tame and lame. They are the ones that can take risks. And I'm very much aware that that is perhaps very much the opposite of what you're hearing, but that is my take on it.
Welcome back at the Sea Arts Podcast. I'm your host, Fabian Sievert, and today we're talking about leadership for artists, but as well the power of artistic interventions for business. Stay excited about this episode at the Sea Arts Podcast. Welcome to the Sea Arts Podcast. We build a bridge between arts and business and want to inspire you to see arts. Well, welcome to a new episode of the Sea Arts Podcast. And today we have the big pleasure to welcome Markus Drün with us. We actually met in the context of the House of the Beautiful Business on their hybrid epic festival, The Great Wave, and got connected. And I got curious because he describes himself as a change choreographer. So I think we're currently all in this dance of change, and I'd like to explore more about his story, but as well how he also builds bridges with podcasting, but also with his methodologies. So yeah, warm welcome to Markus from Stuttgart to the UK.
Thank you very much, Fabian. Thanks for having me.
To kick off, tell us a little bit more about this change choreography, this change choreographer that you're doing, and tell us a little bit more. Who are you?
So let me just take you back into a situation. I think it was February in 2020. I just flew to Berlin to meet a new client. And their situation was they were going to merge with another company. And I came up with about 10 or 12 post-its and I put them on the wall. And I said, well, you know, you asked me what you think we should do, what's good practice. And this is, I think, what you should do. But, you know, this is in no particular order and these things will change anyways. And so then one of the managing directors started to really like move things around. And the way he was moving it around was actually quite expressive. And I thought like, well, it's really like a dance. It's not really a plan. It's more like a choreography. And in this choreography, you are the client, you do the dancing. And, you know, I basically help you look good. And then I reminded myself of, I used to play the clarinet when I was 15 years old, like taking you all the way back now, like good 30 years. And in music, you also have a choreography in some shape or form, or you have a, you know, a symphony and you have the conductor. So my role very much is like the conductor or the choreographer of anything change in an organization, because the biggest issue with change in, let's say, the corporate world is a lot of people like to plan and predict it. And that's just not going to work, right? Predict and control. And so change choreographer for me resonates a lot more because it's all about sense and response. It's all about being in the here and now, and clearly have an aim, have some red lines and golden rules, but then just go with the flow.
Totally. So interesting to share that. It's not so much about like having a fixed plan, but rather in these times more than ever being able to respond, to sense, to feel the need of the situation. Because I think nobody has been in a situation like that where like travel has been so restricted. And but also like currently like all the a lot of businesses are thriving, all the stock markets are on all times high. So it's interesting how we as persons, but also how businesses can face that change. And how did you get into this world of change management, change leadership? You're doing so many things. How what was the starting point or inflection point that you said, I want to help people to change for the better, to change before they have to change?
There was probably, if I can single out one inflection point or moment where I kind of like could see the next 10, 20 years of me, my purpose, my career sort of like unfolding. It was in 2005 when I worked for a big German corporate. I was one of the board assistants. So board assistants is a very funny role because you are quite junior. You carry a lot of people's bags, like metaphorically, like Kofferträger in Deutsch. And at the same time, you're in the room. You're in the room when it happens, where the strategy is being made, where big decisions are being made. And there was this offsite that was led by an American consultancy called Sean Delaney. And their strapline has always been, since the 70s or 80s, I think, the culture shapers. And I thought, like, ooh, the culture shapers. I want to be on that event. Okay, so I was at that event. And it was just magical, Fabian. They were doing what I effectively now do also for a living. They were combining the what with the how. They were combining the biggest business problems with the right people in the room and not just having conversations about strategies and KPIs and, you know, all this kind of business jargon. They were also really working with what was in the room. Like when there was a tension in a small group conversation, I'll never forget this. There was a guy, one of the facilitators, and he almost kneed down, you know, like how you knee down when you receive the knighthood from the queen, like one knee down and the other one up. He was kneeling down and really putting his ear to the table and really looking from almost like underneath what the energy in the room was. And then he said, let me just take you right back to what you just said there and then. And it was about some kind of emotions and one guy triggered another guy. It was very typical, as I, you know, already knew, but would later find out much more. It's a lot about the ego, right? The ego gets in the way a lot. And at the same time, it wasn't coaching. It wasn't training. It was, what was it? And so I asked the guy who ran it and I said, I want to work for you. And he said, well, what's your qualification? And I said, well, I have a business degree from Cologne Business School and I've done a few years here and there. He said, forget it. You are 10 years away from doing what we do. And me being me, I didn't accept that. And I then found myself a consultancy that would basically take me under their wings. And in Germany, we have this much more pronounced dual system, like duales Ausbildungssystem, where I did do an apprenticeship before I did study. And I said, I really like this. They really gave me almost like the induction into the whole world of what you need to know about self-development, leadership development, team development, executive performance, organizational development, and then change. And then there was another moment of truth where I was involved with change programs with a very, very famous consultancy, if not the most famous strategy consultancy on earth. And yes, they are absolutely brilliant. But after the third program with them, I realized, well, hang on a second, how is this ever going to change the business if we keep the same people on board and if those people don't change? And so I then put two and two together and the rest is history.
Nice. Well, thanks for sharing these inflection points and also in a way showcasing that, yeah, if you really are triggered by something, you have to stick to it. And then also like you will find a way to get there. In our podcast, in the Sea Arts podcast, we're always exploring the connection between arts and business. And when you were mentioning this moment of the facilitator kneeling down, really like hearing it from a different perspective, a bit like this, I right now see Sean Connery on the knees in front of the queen. I think there is also like a way how you express yourself. There is an artistic way in this as well. And from your perspective, in your coaching, how do you see the arts and artistic interventions also needed to make a contribution to make this a cultural shift in a way? Is that something that you use and that you think has been useful for you?
Yeah, so there's something, there are a few, I guess, tools that I use on a regular basis. And one is, I mean, it's an incredibly cumbersome word, but it's called das Züricher Ressourcenmodell auf Deutsch, and in English, the Zurich Resource Model. And it's a set of 108 images, I think, very artistic. Some of them are drawn, a lot of photography. And I use this to invoke emotions because an image says more than 1,000 words. And you know, you can do this in a one-to-one coaching setting, or you can do this also in a team workshop. You lay them all out on the table and then you just ask, just pick a card with an image that resonates with you in the context of the breakthrough question, which might be, how can we become a better team? What should the future look like? What do we not like? Whatever it is. And then you just get the person talk about what that picture means. So that's almost like a staple tool that I use. Then another one with regards to change is something that I co-created together with a dear colleague of mine when we both worked at Telefonica, Alexander Frank. There is this term emergence. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Like we like well, the things emerge anyways from the field, but then also in the business world, this has become really central because people have understood that the predict and control doesn't work anymore and that a lot of things emerge anyway. So how can you create the conditions to let things emerge? And also how can you spot the weak signals? Because hindsight, brilliant. But hey, hindsight with a bit of practice, everyone can have. But foresight, that's actually really, really like the high art of, you know, foresightful leadership. And so in order to just get people the concept, because again, I could talk for 5 hours about systems theory and what emergence is and everyone would get bored. And obviously the listeners can't see this, but just imagine any image, and I'm going to point out the one that I use. It's a dog. It's a dog that is sort of like has patches on it, like I think it's a Parson Russell Terrier. And so also imagine now another picture where you just see black dots on the image. It's just a few black dots. You can't really see anything. And I ask the people time and time again, we sometimes do this for 5 to 10 minutes. What can you see? What can you see? What can you see? And then somebody says, I think I know what I can see. And then they have to come to me because they shouldn't really reveal this to the other people. And they say, yeah, you got it. And then eventually we reveal it's a dog. We say, it's a dog. Can you see the dog? And they say, oh my God, yeah, I can see the dog. And then from that moment, they can never not see the dog. But until they see the dog, all they see is dots on the paper. And this is an example I've often used in workshop to really help people understand what emergence is. And there's always one person who's going to see it first. And then it comes to the whole, I guess, viral change process of, is this person a good leader? Can they influence others? Are others listening to them? Are they following them? Because the first follower actually turns the lone nut into a leader. Otherwise, he's just a guy, I see a dog, I see a dog. And it's like, well, I don't see a dog. So anyways, that's one way I use art. There's something that I also have used quite a bit, and that is when you do rapid prototyping. So managers are brilliant talkers. They can talk for England and until the cows come home. They are sometimes not so good in turning their ideas, their talk, into actually something concrete. And when you involve lots of different materials like arts and crafts materials, you actually connect the head with the heart and the hands. And it's amazing. And I remember, for instance, this is probably 4 or 5 years ago when I started to work with an executive team in an energy company. They were talking for 1.5 days. I said, okay, so you've got 2 hours time now and you still haven't got anywhere near a real outcome. Why don't we do a prototype? And initial resistance came up. I put some music on, which helps with creativity, if it's the right kind of music. And then they just became quiet. And guess what? Quality came out in most of us, if not all of them, the inner child. So just getting your hands onto something, just get that playfulness out, which is really important for when you want to come up with an innovative idea. So that's another thing where I use, I guess, in the broader definition of the term art, an artistic technique.
Yeah, well, it is in a way, it is a broad term, but I think like in the training context or facilitation context, you named it like the playfulness. It's possible to ignite the creativity, the inner child, and I also loved how you kind of like help the people to connect the dots, looking forward, seeing the dog at some point, and then you can't see it anymore. So like the arts help in this process. Also, I could see myself in this kind of like pressure moment, then you're not seeing it already, like in this moment. It's always like tricky if like half of the room or 80% are already seeing it and like standing up, you got it, and then you see, hey, why can't I see it? And then at some point you get the right pattern recognition, and that's what I also see, that's what we need for creativity in the end. It's like the right refining our pattern recognition when we
yeah.
When we started today our conversation, we're also checking like how are you feeling, and you already mentioned that you have a certain set of personal routines that help you to to get into the best version of yourself. And that's also something we're always asking, like both our artists, but also like the artistic facilitators, how I would call you right now. Would you like to share a bit about your routines, your rituals, both for self-management, but maybe as well, like, do you also integrate certain rituals into the workshops that you conduct?
Yes. So on most days, I get up fairly early, and it's usually the same sequence of I do breath work. So Wim Hof, the famous Iceman from the Netherlands, I've been using his app for a number of years, and all I can say is it's absolutely transformative. If you do this for like 20 minutes every morning, you start the day on a natural high, on a natural drug, because you create all these wonderful chemicals in your brain that are really conducive for being calm, but also being open-minded and being really, you know, ready to actually show up and wherever you want to go out and deploy yourself. So I usually start with that. Then I do some stretching, sort of like some, you call it yin yoga or restorative yoga. It's usually quite slow, and it's really for feeling good in my body. And I have sometimes some back pain, so just get a bit easy with my back, get ready for the day, because I do sit a lot, you know, and it's good to just get a good stretch. And then I get into a cold shower or a cold bath. And I recently shifted to a cold bath, because you're just immersed in it. It's not an ice bath. I'm not that there yet, but the cold bath, 5 to 15 minutes, however I feel. Again, you come out, and by now it's probably 8:30. You don't need a coffee. You are so high, your body, your mind, everything is just your energy, right? You're on very high vibrations. And then usually I set some intentions for the day. I have a 5-minute journal where I write down what I'm thankful for and also what I really would like this day to be like. And then I do a bit more of what you call manifestation, like positive affirmations. I really zoom into some of the specific areas where I want to just create the reality I want. And then I usually round it up with a, let's call it a formal set of like a meditation practice. Like I'm on the Waking Up app by Sam Harris, and I usually do 10 minutes. And then I'm set to go. That's usually my morning before I do something like this, being on a podcast. Or earlier I co-created some open program to just get people together and have fun rather than serious or boring Zoom calls.
But that's about like 60 minutes, 60 to 90 minutes, like your typical morning routine. And then like you are on this like high on your own supply.
It's probably more 90 to 120 minutes, 1.5 to 2 hours.
Great. Well, I recently read the 5 a.m. Club and have been trying to like nail it at 5 a.m. But like with the kids, sometimes you're earlier, you're awake already earlier. But it's really like for me as well, like the morning is really the time when you earn your day. That's a bit like how I grew up. But I also feel like on these mornings, and sometimes if you sleep in, like you shouldn't kind of punish yourself too much. Oh, you should have gotten up. But it's really like on these days when you got this morning flow, it's really like the dots are connecting so much quicker. And so I can totally recommend everybody to look into that. And what about groups? Do you have certain rituals that you bring into groups? I think it's like nothing you could say in general, but is there some things that you say in your methodology, in your method, that's how you're using rituals for?
Yeah, I do use meditation. I do use very simple forms of meditation when I'm in a group setting, mainly like a body scan or some breathing exercises. And sometimes it's almost like a guided visualization, especially when it's a workshop where you can expect for there to be some emotions. Again, like, you know, get 5 people in the room, specifically the more men in the room, the more pronounced this is. And to just ground everyone in their seat. And that usually is quite, yeah, I don't even think it's esoteric anymore. I think it's, you know, 2021, and a lot of people do that. And then when I do longer events, so I remember last year I did a 3-day event with a client. That's when you have a little bit more control, because if it's an offsite, so you can send people, for instance, what I really like to do is to send people to bed early, at least on one night, and not drink alcohol, and then get up almost like at first crack of dawn, and then go into a forest or into nature and just incubate a question that you're holding. And then you come back and then you, you know, share and deconstruct. And again, it just creates quite a different energetic starting point for whatever business conversation you then want to have. And yeah, I'm always up for the good old energizer, which, you know, brings us back into an artistic, I guess, artistic repertoire. I used to work with a dear friend of mine, Stuart Bewley from Amplify, and he is really good in improv. He's a trained actor. And sometimes I just do improv stuff with people. I just get them up and say, count to three in pairs. Like, we could even do this live now here. So if I say one, you say two, and then I say three. And then you start with the one and I do two and then you do three. Okay, so let's have a go. One.
Two.
Three.
One.
Two.
Three.
One.
Two.
Three.
One.
Two.
Three.
So what happens here? How's this experience for you?
Well, we get into a rhythm. I knew this exercise a bit like from a larger group counting until 10. And then at some point you were kind of like two persons were saying it out at the same time. But it was... yeah, getting into a connection. I felt like a bit, shall we get into a rhythm? Or is it also like, can we use some synapses? No, not synapses, like syncopes. So is that... yeah. That was my experience right now.
Yeah, and then I do this. So yeah, it's all about basically how you don't focus on yourself, how you focus on what the other person does. And that's how you get into like a waltz, like a walzer type rhythm, like one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three.
Right.
So stuff like that I bring in on a regular basis. So it's not necessarily a routine as such that I do this every time with the same team. It's more like it's part of my staple tools and techniques or energizer, if you like. There is one thing I do with most teams. I mean, it's almost the anomaly now that teams are so resistant that you really can't do this with them. And that is the check-in and the check-out, which comes from, it's typically in the agile method, but it doesn't have to be confined to that. And for those of you who don't understand or haven't heard this before, a check-in is just, how am I arriving here? And this could be a one word or this could be a 60-second description. And the key thing is, it has got to be real and honest. This is not pretense. This is not like, you know, oh, it's all good. If you feel shit, you feel shit, right? And if you feel great, you feel great. And you share that with everyone so that they know perhaps later on when it comes to a specific agenda point and you feel a bit tense or you might become a little bit aggressive, they can at least remember, oh, he had a really bad morning, you know, kid is sick at home and wife's at work and, you know, he had to go to the doctors or something. And if you train this as a muscle in a team, it usually becomes quite transformative actually, because we're all humans. And a lot of the businesses say, oh, we are business to business or business to consumer, like B2B, B2C. And I'm like, are you not age to age? Are you not human to human? At the end of the day, it's just talking monkeys behind pixelated screens.
That's where we ended up currently. And that's actually perfectly a perfect transformation or transition to the next question about like us being in front of Zoom or WebEx. Like you also told about your approach to take people to the forest, into nature. How did you cope with this, well, new normal? Is it not already, but in a way, like this new way of doing events, a lot of things happening online, no real human to human encounters happening anymore. What were the creative ways that you found that actually work better online? But what are also some things that you really think that's something that's only working if you're in a physical space?
So one of the things that I personally fully enjoy, I know some people find it quite cringy or even creepy, is the 60-second silence on arrival, or even longer sometimes than that. And it's almost like the bigger the gathering, you know, if you have 200-300 people on a Zoom call, you have all the tiles and that's just one screen. And then you click the right arrow and then you get to the next set of whatever 20, 30 tiles. And most events, meetings just start like, okay, so it's 12 o'clock and I'm the moderator and I say something. And then there are some events, in particular the one you mentioned, House of Beautiful Business, and also Decelerator, which is the brainchild of Gib Bullock. They go decidedly in the other direction. They say, well, what do you actually need when you arrive somewhere? And this takes us all the way back into, like, you know, 50,000 years as a human sapient species, right? So we come out of the forest, we go into the savannah, and we become tribes, and the tribes start to really act more according to social norms. Social norms, who's in the room? And in particular, when you now take this into, let's say, closed events where you have teams or, you know, the top 50 leadership population of an organization, whenever you're in a room, there is a sitting order, and Zoom takes away the sitting order because you're just a random tire. And so just to give people that time and space to check who's there, even if you just, you know, some people call it stalking. I'm just very curious. I sometimes pin people. So I just want to see, because this is what you would do anyways in a room. There's nothing perverse or secret about it. You sit in a room, you get yourself a coffee, and you know, start noticing, oh, you know, Steve is on his mobile. You know, somebody just came in and had a chat. And this is not exactly the same in a Zoom, but at least it's a hack. I call it a hack, where you can recreate, quote unquote, real life when you get people together. So that's something that I personally find works quite well. And anything that just makes it fun, because I hear that a lot of people work more since the pandemic than less. And obviously the whole world has collapsed into this one or two dimensional realm, which is the Zoom on whatever screen you're seeing it on, whether it's a phone or a big, I actually have a big computer in front of me because I don't like bending forward on laptop screens. And so whether it's having a performance dialogue with your employee, a networking event, a training, or, you know, some kind of inspiration event, or a briefing by the CEO, it all collapses into that one plane. And a few things are really easy, so I can give a few more hacks. So one thing on the eye, because it has profound effects on our eyes, and I think, you know, it'll take 2-3 years time for us to really understand what effect it actually has, because previously, yes, we already had lots of times on the computer with emails and stuff like that, but now everything a manager does or anything a professional does is on that screen. So for every 20 minutes, I advise 20 seconds to just gaze something which is the furthest away that you can look at. So where can you look at right now that is at least 5 meters away?
That's a good one. Yeah,
that really helps. That really helps on a very physical level. And then one thing that I encourage people a lot is just go out and have a walk and talk. Easy. Just take somebody with you and have a walk, because it doesn't have to be like that we are perched behind our Zoom screens. And then, yeah, does that answer your question?
Totally. And I couldn't agree more that it's, on the one hand, like, we want to change perspectives, and it's like everything we do the whole day, it's at 80 centimeters of our face, of our mind. How can you create something like mind opening? That's not possible. So really, like, find this work life flow. That's how I like to call it. And as well, like, yeah, check in and check out. I think that's so crucial for all teams, and also check who's in the room. It's also, in a way, it's great that Zoom is democratizing meetings, that everybody's on the same spot. But yeah, in the end, like, if there's still a strong hierarchy in the team, so it's just like a fake democracy, and so it's, yeah, it's interesting how these tools change our working behavior. But I think, like, we shouldn't leave the human side apart, and also, like, unfold as well in the 3 or 4 dimensions, get all senses on board and have fun. I think that's something that we are also working, like, experimenting a lot, like, how can you bring a short, fun, interactive moments to Zoom, to these settings, to really, like, refreshing the audience. And lately, we could also actually collaborate on your newest design of your new podcast. So far, you have the Not Back to Normal podcast. I'd also like to know, why shouldn't we go back to normal? Maybe it's obvious, but also tell us a little bit more about your new podcast venture and as well like the Not Back to Normal podcast.
Yeah, so I started Not Back to Normal in the first lockdown in April 2020. And that was something that has just been, I guess, harboring. I've had this in me for decades, actually, and it just needed to emerge. It needed to come out. And I had some conversations because, as I said, I think I said in the checkout, I'm almost going dark on media, on social media and media for long stretches, actually. I think I haven't been on a single news website like Spiegel or The Guardian in probably 2 months now. So I just get my input from conversations like this. And one of the conversations I had was with a physicist. Now, is that like a GP, somebody who ran an A&E before. Mm-hmm. And he told me, Marcus, we're kidding ourselves. And the politicians are kidding us. And the media is kidding us. There are two paths to get out of this. One is a vaccine that works. And the other one is herd immunity. And ask yourself the question, is there political will in a democracy like the UK or Germany to let up to 5 million people die, of which 80% will be the elderly and people in retirement age, and in particular, if you take those two countries, the people that have rebuilt the countries after the Second World War, there's no way. So we have to wait for a vaccine. And that means until then, we're going to have various kinds of lockdowns. It's a bit like a release system, like first gear, second gear, third gear. And when I was talking to most people, in fact, I didn't quite hear that they heard the shots. And that's when I realized we will not go back to normal. This is bigger than, like, in my career, I've had two distinct crises. One was the dot-com bubble bust. That was more like an economic crisis. And then, of course, the financial crisis in 2008 and afterwards, which then led to all sorts of, I guess, of onward crises. And it started to really emerge how these things are really connected with each other and how Brexit, for instance, in my view, is a direct consequence of how we got out of the crisis and how we completely disregarded, people that are not affluent, for instance. So for me, there was this dawning coming, I guess March, it was in March, April last year, that life as we know it will change. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. So I guess in my intro on the podcast, I had 8 episodes. Yeah, I don't want to go back to normal, because even though the normal worked for me, it didn't work for many other people. And, you know, when you even zoom out then onto the whole planetary level and you talk about the climate crisis that we have, it's just clear that the virus can be seen as a messenger that tells us. It's a bit like Mr. Smith in The Matrix, when Neo asks him, why do you hate us so much? And he takes the thing out of his ear, goes offline, and basically says, because you are the virus that just kills everything. And I recently read Sapiens, the illustrated Homo Sapiens story by, I can never pronounce his name, Yuval Harari. And it just made it very, very clear that we have come to the point where we destroy our very habitat and the habitat for many other species. So there is something, as I said, it's deeper. It has been a calling for a very long time. I'm not particularly like an eco warrior or a protest activist, but I've always had the mindset. I always had the awareness that something is just not adding up in the way we live. And so, yeah, I stopped flying. I've become a vegetarian already before, and I stopped almost any consumption of any products in that I usually would buy, I guess, to just numb some pain that was in me, because I knew something wouldn't add up. So anyways, I'm noticing I'm digressing a bit. So the not back to normal very much was something for me and for my peers, just have a dialogue about why this is insane, what we're doing. And that obviously there should be something afterwards. And so to the second part of your question, I then realized, I think come September, October, that, okay, so that was the right name to start with, but it's not really for the long haul. How can I rebrand, relabel it? And because my consulting business is called Audacify, like, you know, you need to have audacity to lead, big change. And then like Spotify and Shopify. So Audacify, leading audacious change. And that's the name of the new podcast.
Great. Yeah. I think podcasting, actually, I also started my podcast in the pandemic times. I also, as for you, like, was also like a project that was on my bucket list, and it's a great way to ignite conversations, also get in touch with people that you would normally don't meet or not in such intensity, and really like and share. I think that's also the important part, to share that conversation. And yeah, I'm also excited how this Clubhouse thing is adding up to this, like live podcasting. So I also think the intimate conversation that we can have right now, even like if we're sharing, it's of a different quality at the same time. And yeah, can't wait to also tune into the new podcast.
To almost sorry, I want to add one more thing. So the new podcast has a quite a different structure, in the sense that it has a season. Each season has a topic. And then within the season, there is an intro and an outro. And in the outro, probably I get interviewed and I can reflect on things. But then there are five interviews, long form interviews like the previous ones I had. And they are at the five systemic levels. So level of self, you start always with yourself, then teams or maybe even family units at some point, then organizations, then the economic system as a whole, and then the planetary system and even the cosmos. And the first season is called Wholeness. And yeah, I have some, I'm really, privileged and really grateful for the great network I have. And for the first four episodes, I could pull in, you know, people that I know quite well. And yeah, they were amazing conversations about wholeness. So this is a term that Frederic Laloux coined or made popular, let's say, with his book, Reinventing Organizations, some 6-7 years ago. And it was very clear that after Not Back to Normal, which was Corona, let's say, driven and triggered, that wholeness is a process. It's not a destination. If we approach the world, everything we do, with more wholeness, we wouldn't have the mess that we're in. And then I realized, who am I going to get in for the fifth episode, the planet and cosmos and everything? And the point I want to make is, it forces me to reach out into a network that I currently don't have. And I came across a guy called Stephen Reed, who is what you call a polymath. Like he has studied quantum fields in physics, has a degree in there. And then he became a climate activist. And, you know, one of the, I think the youngest board member of Greenpeace in the UK. And also he founded the Psychedelic Society in the UK and does lots of other things. And out of a sudden I pinged him. I said, do you want to come on my podcast? And he said, yes. And so podcasting is an amazing way to almost urge yourself into areas of life, of how the world effectively runs, of how we function as a species, that you would otherwise never do. Because just like you, I need to make a living, and I'm a consultant, I'm a coach, and I have my network and my, I guess, even like my learning platforms for that. But out of a sudden, I was facing, what do I know about cryptocurrencies and decentralized financing? What do I know about hyper-local food kind of like recycling systems and all that kind of stuff? And that all came out in the process of researching Stephen and what he does. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's so great. In a way, it's like you're building your own university. You're curious about something, and then you can put this into the season. And then also you have these five layers that you really like, start with yourself, but also like, I like to call it like zooming in and zooming out, getting into this overview effect to see it, but also like sensing yourself. To almost wrap this up, in your email further, you write more purpose, more leadership, more impact. What are your hacks or your ways? How do you create these superlatives and build this momentum with your methodology, with your coachings, with your with the work that you do?
So more purpose, more leadership, more impact is like a flywheel. You can start anywhere. And that's really important. I'm not dogmatic and say, well, you have to start with why. Yes, we all know Simon Sinek's book and the whole concept behind it. But sometimes it's just not where a client is, for instance. They want to have instant impact. And you always face the question between staying really true to your values and your purpose and saying, no, I'm not going to do that. But then you're not there. It's a bit like you can be in opposition in politics for the rest of your life, for all of your life, and you achieve a little bit, but you will never, ever, for instance, when Joschka Fischer, you know, for the Germans amongst us, when he became actually part of government, that was a complete game changer for him because all of a sudden he was in charge. And that's why I'm saying, like, wherever you want to start, it's fine. But for the purpose of, let's say, purity, let's start with purpose. It really is important that you understand what issue you're actually tackling here. What is the nature of the beast? So it's all about clarity, really. You can frame any change story and focus on story in any shape or form because it's a story. So whatever is important to you, whatever, let's say aim, you could also call it aim, you really have to ask yourself some hard questions. And those are not questions that you can answer instantly. They go quite deeper. So on a personal level, and change always starts with yourself, I use the Ikigai model, which is a Japanese word for the reason to get up in the morning. And in a nutshell is ask yourself what you're good at, what you love doing, what pace, whatever you need to get paid to have the lifestyle that you want, and what the world needs. And if you hit an 8 out of 10, and I'm a big advocate of a hell yes, either hell yes or don't do it. So an 8 out of 10 is a hell yes, and a 7 doesn't exist. I think Seth Godin or Malcolm Gladwell, one of the two, said a seven is already the first yes but built in. So it has to be an 8 out of 10 in any of those four quadrants. Otherwise, you're not really true to purpose. And then on an organizational level, we very often talk about purpose, but there has been quite a bit of purpose washing actually. And at the end of the day, if you look at a business model like, or a business like Patagonia, the outdoor brand, it's very clear what their purpose is. Their purpose is to build and manufacture clothing and equipment that lasts. That has always been the DNA. And so then moving on to leadership. So you know what you want. There is an aim, and there's obviously a current position in the world where you are. So you need to get somewhere. And the only way to get somewhere is through leadership. And leadership for me is very much find your own path. Go somewhere where people haven't been before. Because if you stay on the motorway where everyone else is, it's actually quite hard to get anywhere where it's innovative or differentiated or meaningful. It's probably just another Me Too thing. And for me, leadership is at all levels. Leadership is a process, is almost like you can call it upon yourself to lead. And I know that in organizations, in hierarchies, leadership is associated with rank, with how much budget you have, with how much people are quote unquote underneath you. But if you actually look at the origin of the word leadership and you actually go back to the Retro-Germanisch, like the old fashioned German way, leadership is light, L-E-I-T. And this is, by the way, where we get light culture from, the word. And the light was somebody who went in a battlefield first and probably got killed. And that's where leadership comes from as a word. You go first. You really risk something. And so once you have activated the leadership, the impact almost follows because you can now create a space where people can follow you. So leadership, again, seen through the perspective of followership, the more followers you have, the more of a leader you are. And the more followers they are and work together and you create them. And this is where all the tools come in, whether it's agile or holacracy or OKR, objective key results. They are for me in the impact box. And this is where, again, why I said some people love to start there. And that's fine. But when I get in and somebody says, oh, we already have this agile way of working here, I work with it for a while, but then I bring it back to the bigger picture, the purpose picture. But what do you want to achieve with that? Because that cannot ever be just a mean, just an end in itself. That needs to be a means to it. And so at some point you notice the flywheel between purpose, leadership, and impact is ever more spinning faster. And then things just become easier. And then it becomes, I guess, what's the word? Not, it becomes irresistible, but it also becomes irrevocable. You just can't turn it back.
Well, I love how you visualized it, and also how it's really like building momentum and becoming irresistible, irrevocable, well, at some point, probably like exponentially fast and meaningful. Wow, great. And I think is also something that artists can relate to it, because like it's in a way, like in the art, you see the purpose that you're doing, you see it like the meaning that you create for yourself, but as well, you have to lead yourself through these crises, and then also like inspire others and through that create impact. So I love how you connected these through big buzzwords in a way, in a very meaningful way. I couldn't say more than thank you so much for your time, your insight, the passion that I could feel despite of Brexit coming here to Stuttgart for the work that you do. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our audience, with the young listeners that want to find their way into the arts, your last sparkles of wisdom?
I suppose there is this old adage, do what you love. And the older I get, the more I realize it brings it back to the ikigai that I just mentioned. Yes, that's obviously important. If you don't have passion for what you do, it's really, really, you know, hard. I do also advocate to have a foot in a completely different sector or business or, you know, almost like have a job so that you can actually be free. Because if you constantly have to, you know, if you're constantly just on the kind of like surviving level, it just, you know, we call it brotlose Kunst, and yes, that does exist, but you at some point will face the junction where you actually start to compromise yourself. And I actually, you know, when I was younger, I, you know, collected young artists. And what I noticed is the ones that have something that can keep them, you know, above the waterline financially, they're almost in a paradoxically way, not the ones that go tame and lame. They are the ones that can take risks. They are the ones that can say, look, I can actually do this project because I don't need to make any money with that. So, and I'm very much aware that that is perhaps very much the opposite of what you're hearing, but that is my take on it, that it sometimes is actually more liberating to be a bit more bourgeois, if you like, to have a bit more like a steady income, because then you can just dial in and out into projects that you like, rather than, oh shit, I have to take this project because even the 500 euros I get from that, you know, or from a sale or from a gig or anything, you know,
Cool. Well, thanks so much as well. Like, for on the one hand side, the artist that might want to be always in this existential survival mode and only can create the great art out of this suffering, almost dying, always like not knowing where to go. But at the same time as well, out of a certain position of psychological safety, it might also boost your creativity and also set you free. I think, to all those that are out there, find your way, do art, create and build bridges. That's what we just did. And yeah, thanks so much, Marcus, for taking the time. And yeah,
I actually have another one specifically for any aspiring musician. I just remember I once did a leadership program together with the ACM, the Academy for Contemporary Music in Guildford. I think in the UK, this is fairly well known and fairly prestigious. And one of the things that really surprised me is that they're really young. I mean, we're talking from 14 years onwards to probably early 20s. And the aim and the purpose of the ACM is not to create the next super rock stars, but to create musicians that actually can have a job in music and can make a living with that. And again, quite counterintuitively, they say, well, discipline and reliability goes a very, very long way. You want to be the kid that always shows up on time, is not hungover, but is a fully functioning, it's just here, I'm ready. And And that was actually quite striking. And then a few years later, I did another project where we worked with some of the students there. And that just gave me, again, that insight that it's not all rock and roll. It can be. But at the heart of it is actually a lot of diligent, hard, persistent work, so that when opportunity is there, I think one of the venture capitalists, a famous guy who invested in all the companies that are now quite famous, he said, success is when preparation meets opportunity. And you want to be ready when that opportunity hits. You want to be well slept and fresh. And again, that might be quite counter to the stereotypes that you surround yourself with.
Yeah, so let's stay ready. Let's get ready. Let's see how this whole COVID is leading. But I think like you gave us a lot of insight how to lead yourself. Also, the digital hacks that I love so much about the check-in. Let's find a way. Work hard with discipline. And thanks so much, Marcus.
Cool.
What a treat with Marcus to dive into leadership for artists, but as well the power of artistic interventions for the business space. Another great episode where we are building this bridge between arts and business. We hope we stay excited. Follow us on Instagram @CArtsNow and stay creative.